Welcome to the Dust Off Medic podcast. The views expressed here are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else.
We're going to take care of you, right?
Welcome back to the Dust Off Medic podcast. I'm Morgan, joined here today with Trevor, and we have back on the show Dr. Stephen Schauer, a United States Army physician and prolific researcher working in the emergency department at Fort Sam Houston. Dr. Schauer, welcome back to the Dust Off Medic podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me back.
We're happy to see you again. And today we're going to discuss pain management. This is a broad topic and one that's got some recent updates with the Tactical Combat Casualty Care Guideline update from just a few days ago. Let's start with talking about what pain medications wounded American service member would receive at the point of injury. And then we'll go through the medications that we administer in the back of the aircraft all the way through to your environment in the hospital and talk about maybe what's forthcoming.
So yes, the TCCC guideline update just came out. You know, a lot of it is stuff that we've kind of seen before. It's small little adjustments. Anybody that's in mild to moderate pain, still able to fight, we're still looking at the combat wound medication pack, which contains the combination of Tylenol and meloxicam. Moving further down the options, if that's not sufficient, you move into kind of the mild to moderate pain categories. Then the major dividing point that COTSI uses is whether the patient is in shock or respiratory distress, or they're at risk of developing that condition. So, you know, someone that you think is potentially going to be going downhill in terms of their hemodynamics, kind of divides out which medications you should give. With the primary go-to medications being fentanyl in some various form, whether that is the OTFC, the oral transmucosal fentanyl citrate, or other parenteral administration methods such as intravenous, intramuscular, intranasal. With the last option being if someone is in a risk for shock or already in shock, with the preferred medication being ketamine. They did go to kind of an option of using a standardized dose of 20 to 30 milligrams per kilogram IV or IO. They also caveated it with a weight-based dose of 0.2 to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram IV or IO. So for some of your larger individuals, you may be able to use the weight-based dose to justify giving a bigger dose and still stay within the TCCC guidelines. And then if you're reaching for the intramuscular or the intranasal option, they do recommend 50 to 100 milligrams or 0.5 to 1 milligram per kilogram.
What's the change there? Obviously, this is a small refinement from the previous guidelines, but what changed in this most recent update?
So the one thing I like about the TCCC guidelines is that whenever they come up with a new addition, they make it real simple for people like me to figure out what it is they changed. If you go and download the guidelines, you'll see that it's a very, very small change highlighted by the use of red text. And quite literally, it's just a matter of a very tiny adjustment for the dosing. So instead of having a fixed dose of ketamine at 30 milligrams IV or IO, they've now made it a range of 20 to 30 milligrams per kilogram. And they've also added on the lower end of the range of 0.2 to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram. That's the meat of the change that occurred, was giving you a dosing range rather than a fixed dosing and having the weight-based option available.
Why is that better?
So there's a variety of reasons why I think it's better to have both a low end and a high end. I think it allows them to, you know, kind of make an assessment as to how significant their pain is, number one. Number two, it gives the medic a little more ability to stay within the guidelines and still have some judgment there as to how much they think they should administer, you know, especially based on the size of the soldier. We have, you know, small females that are probably, you know, 100 pounds, ranging up to, a coworker of mine that's, I think he's like 6'8". And so trying to dose the 100-pound female versus my coworker that's 6'8" just doesn't make sense. So I think the range, I think, gives you a little more autonomy in terms of finding the optimum dose range. And then the weight-based dose also allows you to make some adjustments if you need some for the, you know, the much more heavier soldier. So keep in mind that most drugs are based on a 70-kilogram individual. I don't know how many people in the military are 70 kilograms, but I'm guessing that most of them are probably over 70 kilos with, you know, someone being upwards of well over 100 kilos.
We're going to later in this episode discuss other guidelines, the prolonged field care guideline for sedation and analgesia. But I want to jump ahead and look at it for a moment because in the principles of analgesia and pain management, CPG, it includes this sentence: the lower the blood volume, the less drug and time will be needed to achieve similar effects as compared with a normovolemic patient. And then in bold, start low, go slow, which I think is just a great way to remember that part of this is about weight. And then part of this is about the patient's own status and their injury status. It's not just that you look at, you know, one of your colleagues who's real, real big and say, oh, I need more, or small and I need less. It's about looking at their clinical status, your thoughts.
Yeah, so I completely agree. You know, even if, let's say every person that was in the military was 70 kilograms, which would make this, you know, dosing on a weight-based level super easy to do. If you were looking at purely on a mathematical standpoint, like, okay, you have, you know, X number of kilos, you do the X dose here. But you also bring up the other good point, I think, that the dose has to be adjusted based on the severity of the pain. You know, there's some injuries you have that, okay, they do require parenteral medications, you know, something stronger than acetaminophen and meloxicam, or they already got acetaminophen and meloxicam and need something stronger, but, you know, they probably don't need a big, huge whopping dose because their injury is, you know, severe enough that it requires, like I said, some parenteral medication, but doesn't need a huge dose versus people that are, you know, have significant polytrauma and you need a much bigger dose in order to get their pain under control to actually do your assessment. So the dose needs to be tailored on both the size of the individual and, you know, the amount of analgesia or the amount of, you know, pain relief you're trying to provide, you know, balanced out against, you know, their mental status and other things. Beyond just, you know, assuming that you can give unlimited doses of the drug.
So going back, what was that direct quote from where you talked about adjusting the dose? Was that from which guideline?
Yeah, that is page 2 of the JTS Analgesia and Sedation Management During Prolonged Field Care, which is CPG number 61. The lower the blood volume, the less drug and time will be needed to achieve similar effects as compared with a normal volemic patient. Start low, go slow.
So hearing that, like, that's probably one of those elegantly written sentences I've heard. I mean, in my personal experience, pain in a trauma patient can act as a pressor. And when you take away that pain response, you get a bit of sympatholysis and you tend to have a bit of a blood pressure drop and you kind of have to be prepared for it. So adjusting your dosages is important. That and like just basic, think about it as basic as possible. You have less circulating blood volume. You push the medication in. All right. There's going to be more medication circulating through the blood volume if there's less of it. I mean, I really like that sentence out of the JTS. I think it's very elegantly put.
Yeah, I do too. And I think that it is yet another reason, again, not to focus so much on the size of the patient, but to look holistically at their clinical picture. And anytime that we can kind of bring that level of medicine to the less trained medic, it's a good thing. You know, we can incorporate those components of thinking into their decision and not just say, oh, small patient, large patient, you know, what happened? And of course, how do they feel? And that will enter into our discussion significantly later on. But after, again, wounded American soldier in our sort of like large scenario that we'll kind of pursue through the course of this episode. Somebody has been wounded in combat. It exceeds the ability of the combat pill pack to control their pain. They can receive those T3C doses. Can you talk about what is good about the fentanyl lollipop? Doc Rush had a recent episode on PJ Medcast about why a patient ought not to just chomp down on that thing and chew. How does that work? And why is it good to use it in the way it was designed instead of just eating it?
So I'm going to go back to one comment you made here a few minutes ago about the combat wound medication pack. So the one thing I would like to point out about that is that I think that is way either underutilized or underdocumented. Not sure which, probably a combination of both. The number of people that are documented within the DODTR for having received the combat wound medication pack is insanely low. And I suspect that's a combination of both documentation and just not giving it, you know, whether they jump straight to something much stronger or skip over that. But I would encourage people to use that medication first, almost whenever you can. You know, let's say, for instance, it doesn't provide you the analgesia that you're looking for. It doesn't mean that the drug didn't work. It just means you may need to have some additive effect with something else. And I know you did want to talk about the use of multimodal pain control in a little bit down the episode here. But I think that's one easy place you can start with some multimodal pain control is by giving the combat wound medication pack first or even in conjunction with a parenteral medication. So I would like to emphasize that that is available to everyone. It's very easy to give. It's really easy to give, actually, way easier to give than just finding their drug, and to try and start with that. And now your next question about the use of the OTFC. I think what you're asking is why should we use it as labeled as opposed to just taking a big old bite?
Yes, exactly. Right. Because the sort of like the mythology in the infantry is like, if you get one of these, you just chomp down, eat it as fast as you can. Why is that worse than if it's used as labeled?
So the medication actually, it's designed to be infused through the tissue in your mouth. It gets infused directly into the bloodstream as it traverses across the tissue and gets absorbed. The gastric absorption, or meaning the amount that gets absorbed when you swallow it in your stomach, is exceedingly low. It also has to go through first pass through the liver to be metabolized before it even gets out to the peripheral tissues. So if you absorb it directly through the transmucosal route, as is labeled, that actually gets absorbed without any kind of first pass metabolism through the liver. So if you swallow it, despite thinking that you're consuming more, from a physiologic standpoint, anything that's inside your stomach is not yet inside your body doing any kind of physiologic function. It's sitting inside your stomach, but it's not actually inside your body from a physiologic standpoint. So at that point, it still needs to get absorbed through your stomach lining, which is far more dense than what your the tissue is in your mouth. And oh, by the way, it's going to go through your liver where a ton of it's going to get metabolized. So by the time it actually gets out to anywhere where it's going to have any effect, it's been substantially diluted down. So while you may think that you're able to absorb a whole bunch more by taking a big old bite out of it, you're actually doing quite the opposite.
So more is not more in this situation, and that we ought to encourage our patients to use it as labeled and take the appropriate precautions, tape it to their thumb, whatever it may be, but they'll have a better result from consuming it like a lollipop rather than like a bag full of Skittles.
Yes. Yeah. And you also be able to titrate the medication. So let's say for a second that you actually could have gastric absorption, which you don't have much of at all. Once you swallow that big old dose, there's no way to titrate it anyway. So you've kind of done yourself a double injustice there. That number one, the medication is really not going to get absorbed much at all. And then, oh, by the way, even if you did, you completely ruin the effect of trying to be able to titrate the medication.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah. In my operational experience, I've yet to see fentanyl lollipops, but I couldn't imagine doing patient education in the back of a Blackhawk. I guess maybe if you have the patient up on headset, but try to coach them not to chew on it and just leave it in the gums. I mean, in my experience, I would have just put an IV already and administered some IV pain medication.
And the combat pill pack, don't forget, right? And I just want to revisit that for a moment, doctor, but there's nothing that precludes us from administering that pill pack, even if they're an hour post-injury, even if they, you know, air quotes, ought to have received it earlier. We can still administer it if there's no contraindications, of course. We can administer it and it will still have a beneficial effect on our patients in concert with the typically IV medication that we would administer. Is that right?
Yes. There's nothing in the combat wound medication pack that says you must administer this within the first 4.2 minutes of injury or it's a bad juju. You absolutely can.
So looking at the data from the Global War on Terror, why do you think adherence to like pain treatment guidelines are so poor?
So I think there's a number of reasons for this. Number one, I have to attribute some of this to just crappy documentation. Our documentation pre-hospital is often lacking. So I got to imagine the numbers are higher. It's just the documentation is not captured, especially during the height of the war. And also because the DOD hasn't come up with a real great way to capture what happens pre-hospital. While I like the TCCC card, I don't think it's necessarily the easiest way to document because it requires the medic to be doing activities like take care of the patient and then document at the same time. I think there's other ways we could do that better. Either by training non-medical personnel to do your documentation, the same way you do kind of combat reports where you have non-medical or non-combo people doing documentation, other things like body cams, recorders, other technology, I think could be developed to better capture that data. So I think first and foremost, there is an issue with capture the data pre-hospital. So, but we can put that aside and we can pretend for a minute that our documentation is absolutely pristine and perfect and everything we do gets captured. And then why are the things low? Well, number one, if you look at TCCC guidelines, a lot of the medications we're actually asking people to give are not given within their labeled guidelines. So SOCOM, I think, has done a little bit better job of kind of pushing things down in terms of training, and allowing them some more autonomy in terms of giving medications that are off label. But from, you know, big army at large, and I'm going to focus on the army because I'm in the army, big army at large, they haven't found a good way to, you know, disperse medications around the battlefield that are off label. So we'll take, for instance, ketamine. In order to get ketamine around the battlefield, you basically have to disperse a whole bunch of vials of a drug, of which it's kind of hard to keep track of. Each individual vial is not always, you know, they're not serial number, where you can track down each individual vial into one single person. You may have lot numbers and stuff like that, but it's kind of hard to say that this vial came to this chain of command and then ended up, you know, with medic shower or something like that. And you're able to label it as being in his hand. The second thing is that even if you did give it to me, you know, there's nothing that actually, prevents me from pulling the drug out and replacing it with saline and, you know, other types of diversionary methods to actually use the drug is another method. So you have the dispersion problem, and then you have the problem where you're using a drug off label. So now you're training people to use a drug off label. And I'll put aside the fact that we use drugs, other drugs off label on the battlefield all the time, you know, namely whole blood TXA. So you have those issues. And then the other thing we have to bear in mind is that the medics, when they are doing stuff pre-hospital, much like on the civilian side, they have to kind of operate under a medical director of some sorts. On the civilian side, this is much more rigorously defined. You know exactly who's signing off on the protocols. They're responsible for training you. It's their job is to do those things. In the Army, at least kind of on the big Army side, what happens is you have physicians that may or may not want to be brigade surgeons or battalion surgeons or further up the chain. They may or may not want to be in those positions. If they don't want to be in a position, it makes it even more unlikely that they're going to take, you know, a lot of ownership to being the kind of quote medical director for all the medics and then train them. So you had that issue. Let's say we do have a medical director that's very interested in training the medics. The next question is whether they're adequately trained to actually teach the medics TCCC. Up until a few years ago, it was not really a thing that was heavily weighed in terms of residency training was kind of a military operational mindset. So you could come out of residency in something that's completely unrelated to anything pre-hospital, and then be in a position where you're kind of in charge of a bunch of medics and you really know, you know, little to nothing about TCCC. And so now you're being told you have to take this medication, disperse it to all your medics. That's a controlled substance that you yourself have no experience using. You know, so what do you think the likely consequence that's going to be? It's probably going to be that they're probably not going to give them access to the medication unless, you know, absolutely required. And then I think lastly in there is the logistical supply chain issue. Again, you're using a drug off label and you're attempting to disperse this to the sets, kits, and outfits for an off label indication, which also makes, you know, gives the logisticians quite a bit of heartburn as well. So I think you kind of have all those things that are kind of built into the system that are kind of fighting against, you know, having these things available at the point of injury or, you know, near the point of injury where they need to be.
Yeah, it's fascinating contrasting that with some of our partners overseas, especially the French and the Brits, who still carry morphine syrettes as part of their individual first aid kits. And it's interesting here in the U.S., we have such a tough time getting our actual combat medics narcotics to treat pain. It's
along those lines, Doc, why is morphine still a thing? Why do we see it so frequently in the emergency department? Why is it still the go-to for a number of your colleagues, both in the military and civilian practice? And what are the downsides for us using it in the pre-hospital setting?
Well, so morphine itself is not a bad drug. It works decently well when you're using it via like the intravenous or intraosseous route. Where morphine sucks is using intramuscular. It just doesn't get absorbed fast enough. I mean, so if you're using intramuscular morphine, you're talking an onset time and someone that's healthy that actually has perfusion of the tissues, you know, probably 30 to 60 minutes before it takes peak effect if you give this thing intramuscular, which, you know, if you're missing some of your extremities, you know, 30 to 60 minutes is a long time to wait for a drug to kick in. And unfortunately, you know, the morphine that's dispersed on the battlefield is probably almost uniformly in the form of the morphine auto injectors that we bought a ton of that have just residual supply that at this point I think is getting close to running out. So almost all the stuff I think you're seeing dispersed around, a lot of the use you're seeing is intramuscular, which is just like I said, the time of onset is just kind of unacceptable, you know, for somebody with acute traumatic injury. Using intravenous, I think, is still an okay route as long as it's properly dosed. it tends to work okay. The one thing I tend to see about morphine is that it tends to actually be underdosed, especially even when you're giving intravenously. In the hospital setting, you know, anecdotally, it tend to see it underdosed. So and one of the reasons why I think people still use morphine in, you know, probably number two in line of Dilaudid is just because they work a little bit longer than what fentanyl does. But the time of onset, you know, is a little bit delayed.
What about respiratory depression? What about nausea with morphine specifically?
So your rates of nausea are a little bit higher with morphine. You'll still get it with Dilaudid. Both of them cause a histamine release. Dilaudid probably a little bit less so than morphine does. In terms of the side effect profile, fentanyl is probably one of the cleaner medications we give. But again, the downside is it has to be more, you know, more frequently dosed. If you have a, you know, in the back of a helicopter or you're right next to your patient, it might be easier to redose it. In some of the hospital settings where we're operating at inappropriate staffing ratios a lot of times, you know, it may be a while before the nurse gets around to being readministered another medication. So something that lasts a little bit longer is more advantageous.
Yeah, I know our environment in Medivac, I tend to be pretty liberal with pain management because it's one-to-one. I'm sitting there looking at a patient. I can monitor for all of these things in real time and treat them as they come up. And I think that's unique to our environment where I can very aggressively treat pain with little concern.
And, you know, in regards to that, what are some other concerns? You know, we hear constantly about respiratory depression. If you administer an opioid, you have to have Narcan ready, and you have to consider nausea, so Zofran, and then, of course, outside of our environment, constipation. What are some other concerns that you have with the polytrauma patient who's getting a lot of pain medication up front?
So in terms of some of the side effects, I think the major issue that was just highlighted was, you know, how often or how frequently you can actually reevaluate the patient. If you can reevaluate the patient frequently, I can't think of a single instance in which we have had to use Narcan on a trauma patient in a trauma bay because we gave them too much opioid. Almost all the instances in which that happens is because they, you know, decided to titrate their own medications at home with some other, you know, form of opioid they got. So I'm really hard pressed to think of an instance in which it was because we gave too much in a setting where we're able to observe the patient. Now, if you start talking like outpatient setting, that is far different. And, you know, the outpatient setting is not anywhere close to what the TCCC guidelines are intending to reach.
You mentioned histamine release. Do we need to be so concerned that this would progress to anaphylaxis? I mean, what does this look like? What have you seen as far as a kind of allergic reaction to an opioid?
The most common one we're going to see is nausea and occasionally some vomiting. There are some people that will have an anaphylactic reaction to the medication, you know, where they have because of the histamine release. But that's much, much less common than what we do with the more common side effects like the GI upset, the nausea, the vomiting, and some of the other kind of abdominal pain that occasionally can be caused when you use very less desirable opioids like codeine or something like that. But in terms of actual like systemic anaphylaxis, that is still a very rare thing when you administer these medications.
So good. I think it's important to call that out because I think far too often with any medication, in our formulary, we get so hyper-focused on, you know, contraindications, whatever. We wind up focusing more, on the bad than the good. And so I think it's just important to hear from you about that these, you know, medications are on balance good. And while it's good practice to, of course, have Narcan ready, it's good practice to give the patient some Zofran to help with their nausea or their stomach upset. These medications are designed to reduce their pain, not to kill them from cyclic vomiting or some bizarre sort of far marginal side effect. Let's talk about reducing pain, and let's talk about the goal of all these guidelines and pain elimination versus pain reduction. So what are we trying to do here?
Pain reduction. There's going to be no such thing as pain elimination in the acute setting. I mean, at best, a lot of times when patients are asking for pain medications or redosing of medications, I try and explain that the best goal we're going to get to is taking the edge off of it, so it's at least tolerable. We're not going to get to the point that you're completely, you know, pain free unless you're, you know, totally dysfunctional under general anesthesia, which is not the goal we're going to get to. And, you know, oh, by the way, you can't live under general anesthesia. You know, tolerable is what we're trying to aim for. So, you know, help us find a kind of a point at which it's tolerable. And that's the goal we're seeking here. But, you know, expecting your pain that's at, you know, whatever it is, whatever number you want to give it, 8, 9, 10, and expecting us to give you medication that takes it down to zero is probably an unreasonable expectation.
Thanks for giving a good segue into numeric pain scales. You said a pain level of 8, 9, or 10. Every paramedic is trained to ask a patient about their pain in relation to a numeric pain scale. Can you talk about the science behind those scales and why they're maybe more sophisticated than we've been trained to understand?
So when you use a scale like that, it's got a little more sensitivity to change, meaning that when somebody's had some improvement in pain, using a numeric scale or even something much more complicated, like say a visual analog scale, is much more sensitive to changes that occur than simply asking them a binary, like yes, no question. It's a little more challenging to administer, but it's also a little more sensitive to measurements of pain. It also, from a system level standpoint, allows you to do some more, you know, performance improvement in terms of how your clinical practice occurs when you actually have like something that's quantifiable. You know, if you can't measure it, you really can't improve upon it. At least not very well, or at least not in a way that you can actually, you know, objectively demonstrate. So using some sort of objective scale will allow you to at least measure whatever you're doing actually is making a difference.
Okay, fantastic. And that scale, the numeric pain scale, of course, relies on the patient being conscious and able to respond to our questions. There's another scale that gets a fair amount of attention these days, the Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale. I have unfortunately seen it misapplied in the civilian setting to inform a paramedic's decision to chemically sedate or physically restrain a patient. Can you talk about the Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale, what it's used for, and how we can respond at certain levels?
So the Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale was not designed to be used for restraint for psychiatric purposes. It was designed for the intensive care unit when somebody's intubated and needs to be sedated. You need to be able to measure how far their sedation is when they're intubated and they're, you know, attempting to pull out their tube or something like that. It's not designed for the person that's, you know, high on meth, threatening to kill you after they've consumed a bunch of drugs. So you're taking a scale that's not designed for that and kind of like inappropriately applying it. I think some of the reason for that is that we don't actually have a great scale that people have really, you know, kind of widely accepted for psychiatric purposes. And so we've kind of tried to take this, you know, square peg and pound into the round hole of, you know, psychiatric sedation. And unfortunately, this kind of become a standard in a lot of places. And again, it's just not what it was designed for. You know, that'd be kind of like taking the CWAS score and applying that to somebody that's going through acute alcohol withdrawal. The CWAS score just wasn't designed for that, nor has it been really studied in that setting. But because we're looking for some sort of measurement to use, we just kind of take the closest thing we can find that, you know, sort of looks good, and we just kind of apply it, whether it's appropriate or not.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that it has the word agitation. It can become very confused very quickly with people who don't have the training and education in its appropriate use. But the Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale is really designed for the intubated patient and our ability to observe them and kind of estimate their pain in their unconscious state. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at some of the terminology that's used in the Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale, it doesn't apply to the attempt at doing psychiatric sedation for psychiatric purposes. You know, one of the statements is, you know, frequent non-personal movement fights ventilator. Attempts to remove tubes or catheters. I mean, it really doesn't even apply to the patient, you know, with acute agitation secondary to drug use or something pre-hospital.
And yet there it is in my civilian pre-hospital protocols for chemical sedation. So I think it's just important to understand that some of these things that fit nicely on one page that are in a box that have very easily quantifiable numbers, there's some science behind these, and they may be not exactly what they seem.
Yeah. The Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale, like I use it regularly, is phenomenal for intubated patients. Like on critical care transport, it really should be like a part of your vital signs set. but it doesn't work well for your awake and alert patients.
Which is another good segue into a question that I have, doctor. Is pain a vital sign?
So that is a hot topic. The pain vital sign has been one of the reasons that many people have attributed to the opioid crisis. So I personally am not a believer that pain is a vital sign. So your vital signs are attempting to screen somebody for an illness using a fairly objective measurement. The problem with the pain scale is that using it as a vital sign is that there's no real objective way to measure pain. It is purely a patient reported measurement. So, you know, measuring somebody's pulse is an objective thing. There's, you know, there's gold standard measurements we can use to find someone's pulse and then compare that against, you know, the machine that we're using. Same with respiratory rate, same with blood pressures, all those things. There's not really the same thing for pain, which is why I don't think it should be considered a vital sign. I think it's an important measurement, an important tool for it to help you, you know, guide some of your interventions and determine whether what you're doing is working. However, I don't think it should be considered a vital sign for that reason.
Yeah, and I walked you into that. And I think it's just important to sort of understand the vital signs are vital signs, and we can all look them up. Pain as a vital sign was identified. I'm kind of an older person. And so pain as a vital sign was identified as part of a marketing program and has been pretty robustly discredited as part of some pretty insidious marketing that really has like been part of a modern slow motion tragedy. That being said, we do underestimate pain, and we do, particularly in the pre-hospital environment, it would appear, undertreat pain. Trevor, I know this is an important topic for you. This is something that I learned from you directly, that, you know, typically medics are going to hold back. But we know that pain has acute consequences and long-term ones as well. Trevor, what do you think is the reason that people don't treat pain?
Well, some of it was training. I know when I was first trained as a paramedic, I was told pain is the patient's problem. And man, I mean, with that sort of thought, everything's the patient's problem. The disease process is the patient's problem. Why bother with anything? But pain is important. And it comes down to this. By treating pain in the acute setting, you treat the patient long term. So there's plenty of research out there that shows that not treating pain leads to higher levels of post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, and also could play an important role in the healing process downstream. Now, why don't we treat pain? Number one, I think it's a lack of familiarity by especially military pre-hospital providers. For all the reasons Dr. Schauer said before, that these drugs aren't getting to the people who need to administer them, because there's this huge logistical burden that's placed on physicians and oversight and tracking that's very difficult. So I think a lot of their hesitant give it because they've been told all these things about respiratory depression, about nausea, about giving inappropriately. They're just worried and not comfortable with the drug. And I think the first way to overcome that is to gain familiarity. So for all the people out there in the military, go get in partnerships with civilian agencies in your area or military hospitals and be exposed to the drug being used. That is the quickest way. Number two, and this is a bit more insidious and gets me quite a bit more angry, is just sheer laziness. We're going to be transporting shortly. Oh, we're going to be at the facility in 5 minutes. Why am I going to open my narcotics box? Why am I going to do this documentation? What difference does it make? Even if you have a short transport, you're going to be able to open up that little Pelican box, administer that drug, and get at the patient before they get to that facility. Because if you wait for that facility, suddenly they have to get admitted in the process. They have to open up their narcotics. It's just a lot more efficient for the pre-hospital caregiver to give that medication up front. And I think those are my two main reasons I see people steering away from doing pain control.
Does that happen at your level, doctor?
You got to be more specific. Does it happen because of the documentation or because of the admit problem he just outlined, or people are lazy, or
all the above? Because you know, you sort of discussed to some extent the unique nature of the military healthcare system, and that you might have, you know, not to pick on a dermatologist, but you might have a dermatologist who is now all of a sudden the medical director for a dust off company. and they're maybe not so comfortable with ketamine, with fentanyl. Are some of the issues that Trevor identified, a just sort of hesitancy to prescribe some of these kind of heavy hitting medications, or administer rather some of these heavy hitting medications, is that an issue at the physician level in the military because of dogmatic concerns about side effects, lack of familiarity, and all the other things that Trevor spoke to? Does that happen at your level, or does your training, even though it's not super robust to the T3C level, does your training alleviate that?
So absolutely, I think that happens. So I mean, by a show of the hands, how many of the three of us here have ever heard of ketamine referred to as a horse tranquilizer? I mean, so we've all heard stuff like that before. And so if you've never administered the medication before, as far as you know, that medication is in fact a horse tranquilizer that you're about to give to your medics. So I think if you don't have comfort using the medication, it's going to be highly unlikely you're going to give this to somebody to administer that. Oh, by the way, is, you know, how many miles away, you have no direct oversight, and you've never actually, you know, directly seen him administer the medication. So yeah, absolutely, that happens. And if it's, you just happen to be in a field that doesn't, you know, administer this medication on a regular basis, I think you're going to be uncomfortable dispersing that somewhere where people are going to be, you know, out of sight with that medication, you know, when you sort of on the hook for it, but sort of not. As for the question about the laziness, I think that's a hard one to kind of quantify. I have no doubt that it absolutely happens. You know, that happens for, you know, on multiple different levels. It happens that either whoever's administering the medication is a little bit lazy about getting around to administering the medication, or it happens because the patient or the nurse came to the physician and asked for an order for medication, and I was lazy and just didn't get the order put in a timely fashion, or I just completely forgot about it. I have no doubt that you know, all those things, you know, kind of permeate across. And then he also highlighted the thing about you may be in the facility in a few minutes, but it's not going to be instantaneous that we whip out the medications as soon as they get there. So even if the patient has, you know, gotten out of your truck or your helicopter or something like that, there's still going to be a bit of time as they get checked in before anything actually happens.
Yeah. So I know on my last deployment, we had access to a whole host of different pain relievers, from opiates to NSAIDs, IV, PO. And just thinking offhand, we had access to IV Tylenol. We had access to Toradol. We had access to Dilaudid. We had access to fentanyl. We had access to ketamine, morphine. And there's a lot of different ways that people administer these medications synergistically, or using a multimodal pain relief strategy. What's your approach, Dr. Schauer?
So yes, I completely agree with using a multimodal pain approach for a number of different reasons. I think the main reason is that you can give smaller doses of each medication, and they have more than just an additive side effect. So they actually have a synergistic effect to them. So when I say additive versus synergistic, additive would mean that, you know, if you take it down 2 points with morphine and 2 more points with Toradol, it kind of happens in linear fashion, where if you combine the two of them together, it may turn out that you actually take it down more than 4 points total. You take it down 6 points. And the advantage of using smaller doses of each medication is that you're able to get a lot of the positive effects of the medication with less side effects. So, you know, it's like the toxicologists say, the only difference between a drug and a poison is the dose. So if you use a smaller dose of the medication, you may still get many of the positive side effects without the negative side effects to it. So let's take, for example, NSAIDs. For a while, NSAIDs, you know, before we realized that, you know, giving everyone opioids is a bad idea, NSAIDs kind of got a bad rap that they do have some long-term effects to them. And it turns out with NSAIDs, a lot of the negative side effects we see, such as GI bleeds, you know, loss of kidney function, those kind of things, are actually kind of dependent on two things. Number one is the dose, and number two is the duration of the medication. So they're heavily dose and duration dependent, a lot of these side effects are. So if you can give a smaller dose, that automatically starts to reduce the effect, or likely that they're going to have some side effect of it. So instead of having to give some big, huge, whopping dose of Toradol, which may also carry with it some side effects, you can give a smaller dose in combination with a smaller dose of morphine. So now you have the positive effects of Toradol combined with the positive effects of morphine, or positive effect of Dilaudid, or whatever it is, without having to use a big old whopping dose that's going to cause them to vomit from the opioid, or have, you know, some sort of GI dysfunction from the, you know, very high dose of Toradol. So by doing that, you're able to get more positives of each drug with less than negatives. I'm actually going to pull up a quote. This is from the prolonged field care guidelines, came out 21 December 2021 here. So they say here, similar amounts during redose. In general, a single medication will achieve its desired effect if enough is given. However, the higher the dose, the more likely the side effects. Then they go on to say that ketamine, opioids, and benzodiazepines given together have a synergistic effect. The effect of the medications given together is much greater than a single medication given alone, i.e. the effect is multiplied, not added. So go with it less than what you might normally use if each one were given alone.
So I think they kind of highlighted that method of using multimodal pain approach well within the prolonged field care guidelines that just came out a few weeks ago.
In preparation for this episode, I was, small plug here, I was using my free access to UpToDate that I have from the Army to read their article entitled Pain Control in the Critically Ill Adult Patient. And it describes benzodiazepines and opioids as potent potentiators of each other, which made me think of an old Saturday Night Live sketch, but also made a lot of sense. They work well together and they help. It refers back in some sense to our earlier discussion of the combat pill pack on top of or administered along with some of these heavier duty pre-hospital medications like ketamine and fentanyl. Toradol came up. Though, can you talk about that medication? It's getting a little bit more traction in the civilian pre-hospital setting, particularly for like kidney stone pain. What is Toradol and how can a military medic use it effectively?
So Toradol, or if you want to stick with the generic name, Ketorolac, is an NSAID. It falls in the same category as, say, you know, ibuprofen, naproxen, diclofenac, all those medications. One of the potential advantages of it is that it's administered parenteral or oral. But typically, I think the more common thing we see is it's administered parenteral, at least in the emergency setting. So IV or IM. The reason why that medication was kind of hated on for a number of years is, again, it has a little bit of a side effect profile, especially when you're using it for long-term repetitive dosing. But in terms of short-term use, the medication is relatively safe. And also, we're using much smaller doses than what we used to use a number of years ago when people were seeing a lot of side effects. So, I mean, your typical dose range for most adults, you know, that you don't suspect any kidney disease on is going to be like 15 to 30 milligrams. The dose that we were seeing a number of years ago in Toradol was used, I mean, years ago, I mean, like, you know, 90s and stuff like that, is you're talking like 60 to 90 milligrams of dose. And it turns out the drug probably has a pain effect ceiling somewhere between 15 and 30 milligrams. And so we don't really need to go above that. And by the way, if you reduce the dose, like we talked about, it does reduce the amount of side effects you get. So, you know, that medication, I think, is becoming much more frequently used as people are trying, you know, hard and hard to avoid opioids as the first go-to medication.
A couple alibis. The PFC pain management guideline refers to pain in three distinct categories: background pain, breakthrough pain, and procedural pain. What do those mean to you? So I don't just read directly off this CPG.
So background pain is the pain they have as a result of whatever it was, the injury that happened. You know, so if they happen to have, you know, their extremity blown off, they broke their femur, they have a gunshot wound, they have a fall. That's what background pain is. That's the existing pain. They basically, when they showed up to you, that's the pain they already had before you even got involved. Then you have what they call breakthrough pain, which is pain that, you know, was controlled and is now no longer being controlled by the medications you've given for a variety of reasons, either because the drug is wearing off, you know, their adrenaline's wearing off, or something in their, you know, status has kind of changed and requires, you know, additional medications to deal with the breakthrough pain. And then the last category is procedural pain. So procedural pain is basically kind of pain that, you know, in a simplistic way is pain that you've induced. So either you're having to, you know, reset their dislocated extremity, you've had to move the patient, you've had to do some sort of procedure because they have a pneumothorax and you have to stick a chest tube in, which is incredibly painful. That's procedural pain. So I like the way in which they kind of lump into three different buckets, not necessarily because your treatments are going to be all that much different, but it kind of forces you to go through the thought process of what exactly it is you're treating. You know, I think sometimes people get, you know, hyper-focused on exactly what is written down on that piece of paper. You know, if everything was, you know, totally discernible by writing down a set of rules on a piece of paper, they could basically just replace us all with a bunch of robots or a bunch of very highly trained monkeys. You know, but actually taking something in those three thought processes and actually interpreting what's going on with your patient as a whole,
is what makes us, you know, uniquely skilled, uniquely important, in terms of taking care of patients.
Yeah, I think this topic is something we could talk about for considerably longer than one episode or 1 hour. And I think it's important for all our flight medics or medics out there to sit down and have a discussion with your medical control physicians, your flight surgeons, and talk about pain management. Because I mean, thinking offhand, how many different medications I have used to obtain relative analgesia, I mean, I couldn't even count how many different combinations I've used just in the past year. So I think this is an important discussion to have with your physicians and then basically talk it out, game it out with them, give them presentations and see what they would want you to do. I think that's a really effective way to go about this.
I mean, so much of our job is pattern recognition, right? And so we are going to treat patients sort of based on what the last time we saw or, you know, what our training and experience informs. But, one of the things that our co-host colleague Max says a lot is that the mark of a good paramedic is the ability to anticipate the clinical course of a patient. And this is kind of the flip side of that, is sort of understanding like what the underlying issue is and treating that with the appropriate, in this case, medication, and not just be a cookbook paramedic. I'd like to do our lap around the Department of Defense now and look at some of the other paramedic level guidelines. And it's always my favorite thing to start with the Navy's aviation medical treatment protocols. I think that they actually have really good protocols, but the clip art, man, I hope they keep that forever because it's just ridiculous. but anyhow, doc, this is relatively consistent with the T3C guidelines, except for boom, right off the bat, pain management medications, morphine. Is this the right medication to be administering in the pre-hospital setting? You talked about its use in the hospital. You talked about some downsides. Obviously, we're going to be respectful of our colleagues here, but what in the heck is morphine doing as the first medication mentioned in this guideline?
Okay, so with regards to morphine, I still think morphine is okay to use when you give it IV or IO. The IM morphine, I think it needs to go. I don't see any use for IM morphine in the acute pain setting. Like I said before, it doesn't get absorbed fast enough. The dosing and the absorption is not real consistent in terms of timing. The IM morphine, and if anybody else knows where the stockpile of morphine auto-injectors are, please take them and throw them in trash or burn them or something. The second thing is that dose that they have right there, I think is really underdosing your patient. So let's say you're going to use morphine. I think you need to use a more adequate dose, which an adequate dose is closer to, 0.1 to 0.15 mgs per kg of ideal body weight.
And it says here, for the folks who don't have the benefit of reading along with us, this is a 2 milligram IV or IM with a maximum total dose of 10 milligram dose of morphine.
Yes. So for your average soldier that is significantly injured, we're talking maybe 6 on the low end or 10 on the high end IV for what you'd be using for acute pain control. 2 milligrams is, it's kind of a fart in a windstorm in terms of the volume that you're giving them. It's going to be insufficient. 2 milligrams, while it may provide some analgesia, it's getting closer to like a placebo end of dosing. So if you're going to use the morphine and expect it to have any kind of result, it needs to be dosed properly.
Speaking of farting in a windstorm, next line, fentanyl. 1 microgram per kilogram for a maximum dosage of 100 micrograms. Your thoughts?
So I think 1 mic per kilo is an okay dose to start out with. I mean, the common theme we've seen across most of these guidelines is that you can always give more, you can't take away. So I think 1 mic per kilo is a totally reasonable dose to start with. I'm not sure where they got this max dose of 100 micrograms from, though. You can easily break through 100 micrograms of fentanyl for somebody that's significantly injured, and they're still going to be wide awake, screaming in pain, tachypneic, tachycardic, and hypertensive from their pain after 100 micrograms. So I think that cap is completely inappropriate in terms of, where you're capping somebody out at. And then I don't really understand exactly what they're getting at. So if they're trying to say we need to cap out at 100 micrograms, I guess after 100 micrograms, then we stop treating the pain. I'm not really quite following what the algorithm is here, or if they're trying to tell you need to go to something else. But I think the 100 micrograms is a bit low in terms of a cap. I think it goes back to what one of you guys has said earlier, that, it's kind of based on your reassessment of the patient and having close contact with the person, especially during the transport time and stuff like that. You can easily redose and go well above 100 micrograms safely and effectively. as long as you're, you know, observing them and monitoring them properly.
Trevor, how fast would you go through 100 micrograms on your average
transport? 20 minutes. I personally usually start with a 50 microgram bolus for most average size people, see what it does and re-bolus as necessary. It's hard to tell what they're getting at with this guideline, if they mean 100 micrograms for a single dose or 100 micrograms as a total dose. And I think it's a bit too vague. As an end user, I would hope it's just 100 micrograms for a single dose.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised to see these consistently low doses. I will point out that this is dated April of 2019. And so, of course, does not incorporate the updated T3C guidelines and maybe some changing thoughts on the Navy side. Let's go over to the PJ handbook. Let's see, 8th edition here, which is coming out of 2020. And this is fairly consistent with the Army SMOG and then the T3C. Couple special considerations here. At the top of the page, document a mental status exam prior to administration of opiates and ketamine. I've got personal experience with this. You know, physicians who are unaccustomed to seeing patients that have received ketamine can get a little grumpy when a patient comes in having received pre-hospital ketamine. I'm talking about civilian practice now, not military, because it does often take away a patient's mental status exam. What can a pre-hospital provider do to give folks at your level a kind of a warm and fuzzy if they're giving ketamine?
I mean, I think a good documentation, or at least providing us a good description as to what their mental status was before the ketamine is helpful. I mean, that said, the effect of the ketamine that's typically given pre-hospital for pain is not that high. That you know, any kind of transient, you know, kind of you know, delusions they may be having are usually wear off pretty quick. Somebody that's got 30 milligrams of ketamine pre-hospital, that is not going to have them acting loopy for hours on end. Usually that's something that'll go away within the first, you know, 10, 15 minutes they got there if the medication was just given.
Anything else jump off the page? This point about IM or IN absorption of opiates in trauma patients is variable. That's great.
I really like this guideline. This is very well written, in my opinion. This breaks down exactly how I, without referencing a guideline, think about pain management. The way they break it down into mild to moderate pain, then hemodynamically stable versus hemodynamically unstable, is exactly how I think about treating pain. And I like the medication choices. I like the way it's written. I think it gives the user a lot of options based on the presentation.
Yeah, I would agree. I think this is actually a pretty robust guideline here, and, you know, pretty in line with what most of the evidence shows. I mean, the only thing I'm really noticing that's standing out is perhaps that, you know, Motrin probably has a dosing cap around 600 milligrams without much benefit going up to 800. But I mean, that's like a pretty minute point to pick out there.
Hey, along those lines, because it just jumps out at me here in red, it says avoid ibuprofen and ketorolac in injuries at risk for hemorrhage due to antiplatelet activity. That's definitely part of our training and education, that we kind of stay away from some of these NSAIDs because they might cause antiplatelet activity. What do you do about that? How easy is that to reverse? If you get a wounded soldier who just, you know, is walking around with back pain, you know, or joint pain because of a 20-year military career, and they're popping ibuprofen, they're taking Motrin like candy, and now they're bleeding particularly badly. What do you do at your level to reverse that? How easy is it to reverse, and what can we do to help you?
I actually can't think of a time that we have specifically done any sort of reversal because, you know, somebody had some Motrin pre-hospital. I mean, I know that there is some, you know, at least physiologic justification for, you know, not giving these medications after somebody is injured. But I can't say I've seen any really robust data showing that, you know, somehow people that were taking Motrin were suddenly at, you know, significant risk for massive hemorrhage as opposed to people that weren't taking Motrin, as if it has any major clinical, you know, clinically relevant effect from it.
So they're not going to bleed like the little old man who's on warfarin, is what I'm driving at.
No. I mean, if that was the case, you know, we would have people in the military be coming in with, you know, intracranial hemorrhages all the time. You'd have every single soldier that, you know, most people that have been in any kind of like, you know, physically demanding job has probably taken Motrin pretty frequently. And oh, by the way, because their job they're in, they're probably also subjected to, you know, occasional falls and stuff like that. We would be seeing people coming in with brain bleeds all the time, which we're not. So, yeah, I mean, it's not like you're putting somebody on, you know, Coumadin or Xarelto or something like that, where they're very prone to bleeding.
So it's still good practice for line medics to nudge their infantry colleagues away from some of those medications, but it's not necessarily going to cause them to hemorrhage on the spot.
No.
Perfect. Thanks. Okay. So here is the Ranger Medic Handbook. And this, of course, is going to be the kind of best U.S. military point of injury care that we know of. And it goes right back to those T3C guidelines: fentanyl, ketamine, addressing the nausea, vomiting, maybe some NSAIDs, but really encouraging an aggressive treatment of pain with those first line medications of ketamine and fentanyl. And how about their flow chart here? Administer combat wound pill pack. What is this medication cell right here?
Celebrex.
Celecoxib.
Yeah, so the brand name is Celebrex. It's one of the selective COX-2 inhibitors.
What do you think? Should it be in here? Should it not?
I mean, I think it's absolutely okay to do. I mean, it does carry with it some of the same, you know, potential physiologic risks of some platelet dysfunction. But again, you know, the potential physiologic risk versus actual like clinically relevant outcome is highly questionable there. Now, I think people kind of get lulled in this false sense of safety with Celebrex long term compared to some of the more traditional NSAIDs, and it still carries some of the same risks when you use it long term. But it definitely is I think a very appropriate treatment. I mean, the other thing we have to keep in mind is that, you know, most of the injuries that medics are going to be treating are not, you know, major casualties that were, you know, blown up in a big, huge explosion or injured in a gunfight. Most of the injuries the medics are going to be treating are the people that had the hard landings and now their ankle's broken, their back is sore, you know, they're banged up with bruises, they had a fall. I mean, they got poked with something when they fell down or, you know, a stick or something. It's not going to be major trauma. So, you know, I think while the major trauma stuff certainly gets a lot more attention, most of the stuff the medics are going to be doing day to day is going to be, you know, much more limited injuries, like orthopedic injuries and stuff like that, where NSAIDs are actually going to be very beneficial.
Excellent. And I've got in front of me the ATP handbook, pretty consistent with the other ones we've seen. There's nothing that jumps off the page as being different here. Morphine is still in this guideline. And there's just a little bit more attention paid to a sequential administration of, you know, Tylenol, Mobic, Motrin, Toradol, et cetera. So with all of those being accounted for, let's turn our focus now to the Army Standard Medical Operating Guidelines and see how it diverges from this standard of practice, if it does at all. I do appreciate that in the center of the page, it has a numeric pain level above which, that is a 3 out of 10, you should consider a patient to be in pain and treat it. I think we talked earlier about how you can't be a cookbook medic, but here is probably a decent cookbook formula for when you ought to be reaching for your pain medications.
The one thing that sticks out to me, Morgan, is right under it says pain greater to 3 out of 10. It says vocalizes/signals pain and requests relief. This gives the medic a lot of flexibility because we've all had patients who are rather stoic. They're saying they have 2 out of 10 pain or 3 out of 10 pain, but I see them grimacing, tearing, writhing in the stretcher. So it gives the option to give patients like that some sort of pain relief.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that if you've got a military member who's asking you for pain medication, you're probably already a little bit behind the curve. So thanks for bringing that up. Really nothing else here other than ensuring that you're monitoring vital signs, which seems obvious, but could also be something that could be easily missed. And then all of a sudden you're falling behind as a patient desaturates or something like that. So I think these are all good. Sometimes I don't really think that the SMOG is the best guideline, but as we've gone through these, I think it's pretty effective and pretty straightforward. What are your thoughts as you look at this, doctor?
I think it's actually a pretty decent guideline and in line with a lot of the other stuff we looked at. The only thing I do want to point out is that, you know, with the use of, say, ondansetron or some of the other antiemetic medications, that there's no such thing as pre-treating someone before they become nauseated. There's been randomized controlled trials attempting to look at this, and pre-treating someone before they even develop nausea is not actually a thing. You know, for instance, if you were just to give them a prophylactic dose of Zofran, it doesn't actually work. So you do not need to give somebody Zofran every time you give an opioid. If they complain about nausea or vomiting, then, you know, certainly treat the nausea and vomiting, but pre-treatment actually has no real effect.
Okay, that's awesome. Because I think that that's totally part of pre-hospital dogma, is that like they go hand in hand, and you can sort of preload somebody on Zofran. Totally diverging from that. What do you think about alcohol wipes for the treatment of nausea?
So there has actually been studies looking at that. A lot of it originates, there's a little bit that originates from some folklore, but also from the anesthesia literature is kind of where a lot of it has started out. And then, interesting enough, there was a study done by Mike April at BAMC that showed it was effective. Patients were basically treated with alcohol wipes, and their nausea actually significantly improved. Yeah, I would encourage you to kind of, you know, try it. The nice thing about the alcohol wipes is that I have yet to see a single side effect from this. So I haven't seen where anybody's, you know, their nose is exploding or anybody's dropping dead because they're sniffing some alcohol pads. There's definitely some well-described side effects with Zofran and all the other antiemetics out there. So there's a little downside to trying it. So I'm always a big fan of medications or treatments that have, you know, little or no downside, and trying them first, even if perhaps it may be some sort of a, you know, placebo effect that's going on. But again, I mean, there's a lot of psychosomatic component to nausea. So yeah, please consider trying the alcohol wipes. Safe, maybe effective.
Dr. Schauer, kind of sounds like we need you back on the podcast sometime to talk about treating nausea and motion sickness and addressing all the dogma that exists in the aviation medicine community.
Well, I may be thrown off your show because I'm not a huge ondansetron or Zofran fan. So who knows? I may get tossed off your show if I start talking about other more effective ways to treat nausea.
Yeah, or we might just keep having you back. I think that, if you're going to reach for the Zofran, you can easily stop by the alcohol wipes on your way. And there's pretty, like you described, robust evidence that indicates that it's effective anti-nausea medication, I guess you would call it in that sense. But worst case, nothing happens. And then you can administer the Zofran later. One last alibi that I have is, do you guys talk about the opioid crisis at your level, at the committee level, when you're talking about fentanyl, you know, these medications that have killed thousands of our citizens? Do you talk about those things, or is it really strictly about the efficacy of the medication in the moment?
I couldn't tell you. I'm not in the TCCC committee, so I couldn't tell you what conversations they've had. In reviewing some of the recent position paper that will likely be coming out in the near future, those things are talked about. The only thing I would kind of caution people about a little bit associated with, you know, trying to link pain medications you've given pre-hospital or pain medications that you've given in the emergency department via like the parenteral route, is that there's really not any good evidence showing that the medications you give in the emergency department or the pre-hospital setting are really linked to someone's long-term outcome or potential long-term use or misuse of opioid medications. That said, there is actually pretty decent evidence showing that prescriptions that we discharge people home with from the emergency department actually do have pretty substantial effects on whether they're likely to be, you know, to have some sort of downstream, opioid addiction. So it's not that there's zero evidence. It's just that the only evidence right now is really linking it to the stuff we discharge them home with. So, you know, if you discharge somebody home with, oxycodone, hydrocodone, or some other opioid, the discharge prescriptions are at certain levels, higher levels, linked to more likely becoming addicted to medications. But the medication you give in the back of your ambulance or your helicopter or the IV, the single IV dose that I give in the emergency department, there's no evidence linking that to long-term abuse.
Let's focus on that. Any medication that we give, we should be conscientious about. We should do the six rights and all the things that we do. But maybe with this episode and this discussion, we can take away a little bit of the fear that that fentanyl you give to the patient with a broken femur, you know, or whatever, that's not necessarily going to be the first step that causes them to become addicted to opiates and all the bad things that are associated with that. We're more talking about the vial of pills that they go home with. That's the risk. I know you just said that. I just want to emphasize it because I think that it's related to something that Trevor talked about earlier, which is the hesitancy of pre-hospital folks to give this medication because they're concerned that they're going to send this patient under the bridge to die. So I just want to highlight it.
Yeah, there's really no evidence linking that. There is evidence. You know, the data has gone back and forth a little bit, but I think the preponderance of the evidence is that early treatment of pain actually improves long-term psychological outcomes. And he did mention that earlier with PTSD, anxiety. And those are things that don't show up right away. So it's not like you're going to have somebody that has some sort of traumatic event and then they're diagnosed with PTSD, anxiety, or some other, psychiatric diagnosis within the first like 7 days of being in the hospital. These things are something that sometimes takes months or even years before they get developed and really diagnosed. So I think there's really more potential upside than there is any downside, since at this point, there is no data showing downside to, you know, one or two doses of a medication pre-hospital.
Okay. Now, Dr. Schauer, we know you, as I said in the introduction, a prolific researcher. Can we entice you to talk about what might be coming down the pike in terms of battlefield pain management? I'm interested in knowing if you're studying anything now, if you are aware of any changes that are coming to the guidelines. I know one was recently published, but I think about Penthrox. Is there discussion of using that medication? Are there other medications that are up for discussion? Dexmedetomidine?
As for things that are in development, so there is one thing in development I think is probably very interesting to people, and that is the use of ketamine auto-injectors. You know, I'm aware of at least, two funded efforts to develop ketamine auto-injectors, and there's probably more that I'm unaware of. So I think ketamine auto-injectors will be coming. One of the major sticking points with the ketamine auto-injectors is that, number one, the ketamine, you can't develop a device to inject a medication for an off-label indication. Ketamine as a pain medication is off-label. And so you have to find a company that's willing to study it and get the actual labeled indication. To that end, though, the FDA has been more frequently using existing literature that's published as a justification for developing a labeled indication, meaning that you don't necessarily have to conduct your own de novo experiment, to satisfy the FDA requirements for developing indication. So there's a substantial body of literature published on ketamine as a pain medication, which may potentially ease the process of getting the labeled indication we need. And then, you know, in the downstream effect of developing a ketamine auto-injector. I can't mention the companies that are involved or exactly what the effort is, but you will be seeing a ketamine auto-injector coming out in the future.
So this is great because it addresses the reasons that we might not, you know, we sort of think we sit around and talk about things that we'd love to see, but understanding some of the regulatory framework that exists in the background and why it's not so simple as just pouring a medication into an auto-injector and sending off thousands of them to your local APO.
Yeah, other things that people have looked at is the use of S-ketamine. So ketamine is actually an enantiomer, meaning that there's essentially like a right and a left hand to the drug that mirror each other. With the S-ketamine thought to have more of the good stuff and less of the bad stuff. Based on what I've seen, I'm not quite sure that's going to pan out to be, you know, some great thing that's going to come along. But there are companies interested in developing S-ketamine. So, yeah, I think that's probably one of the bigger things we're going to see coming out. Dysuvia, which we didn't talk about, is going to be disseminated into the sets, kits, and outfits as a standard medication for deployment. That is the sublingual sufentanil, which the DOD has sunk a ton of money into developing and bringing to the drug development process, using the expedited military pathway with the FDA to get it out to market. The main downside to Dysuvia right now is that there's not a lot of great data supporting its use in the acute setting. If you look at most of the literature on Dysuvia, most of it's been done on what are typically used as kind of like pain models for getting a drug through the FDA. It doesn't necessarily apply to the acute pain setting. So the main downside, like I said, is there's not a lot of data supporting its use in the acute pain setting. However, we will be seeing Dysuvia downrange.
Well, Great. What's the worst that could happen? any other medications? Are you conducting any research personally right now in this topic of pain management?
Prospective studies, no. I will make a plug that we did just publish a retrospective study looking at dosing of ketamine within the DoDTR. So it's out in Military Medicine. I think it just came out maybe last month or something. If you guys want to look up, Grace Babarda is the first author on the paper. So we actually go through and kind of look at the dosing of ketamine, what we're actually giving. And it does appear there's kind of a mismatch between clinical practice and what's in the TCCC guidelines. So I'm not sure if that means that, we would like to give bigger doses, or if it means that, COTSI is using a smaller dose than what we're, what we think the patient needs. But there does appear to be a mismatch in terms of both the IV and the intramuscular administration doses between what we give and what's in TCCC guidelines.
I will be sure to include a link to that paper in the show notes. As we come to a close here, do you have anything else off the top of your head that you'd like to discuss? Any other future research that you're planning that you need some assistance of military medics with? Anything you'd like to riff on before we close?
When it comes to pain stuff, no. We do have a couple other studies that we're about to start doing with the military medics. Since the grants are not yet awarded, they're still in negotiation phase here. I'm not going to spill the beans as to what we're looking to do. However, I'm always interested in studies that involve medics. I personally think that's kind of one of the most underutilized things we do in the military is a lot of R&D that doesn't involve the end user. So I personally both enjoy, and I think it provides the most benefit, I think, if we involve the end user in the development process for whatever kind of scientific developments we're looking for. Whether that be in the form of a randomized controlled trial or if it be in the form of a qualitative study of some sort that gets end user feedback to better enable us to bring, scientific solutions that actually meet the end user's needs instead of us trying to, guess ourselves along the way.
It almost sounds to me like you are inviting folks to come to you with problems that they may need help solving. Is that right?
I am always open to people coming to me with problems that they would like solved. I can't guarantee I'm going to solve all of them. However, if we don't identify what problems it is that people are seeing, it's kind of hard to find a solution for it.
Yeah, fantastic. And, opening your door like that is very meaningful to our community. So we really appreciate it. And we will certainly get anybody who writes into the show in touch with you. And I'll give our email address and such at the close. I'm out of questions, Trevor, if you have any.
I just want to go over a couple particularities of the transport environment, just some last minute pearls from personal experience. So first, it doesn't matter your patient's presentation. If it's a point of injury with a field amputation, if it's a guy with a broken femur from falling off a ladder or a dislocated shoulder or a critical care transport, intubated patient post-surgical. Patients, when they're introduced into the transport environment, will have an increase in pain levels every single time. This will be most dramatic with your patients who have long bone fractures. And it's best to get ahead on these patients and treat them up front with the pain. Because as soon as those rotor blades start turning, they're introduced to this noisy, high-frequency vibration environment, they're going to have a dramatic increase in pain. And the second thing is, in my belief, it's more that you treat the pain than you think too hard about which drug you're giving, especially in our hemodynamically stable patients. Treat their pain. It's one of the most important things we can do as medics in the field. And there is a ton of evidence behind it and that this affects patient outcomes. So please, please, please treat your patient's pain.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a voice of a lot of experience in the pre-hospital rotary wing environment. So terrific. Dr. Schauer, thank you very much for coming on to the Dust Off Medic podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. If you are using these episodes as part of your training program, we would love to hear from you. You can reach us at contact@dustoffmedicpodcast.com, and we are on Instagram and Facebook, Dust Off Medic Podcast. We'll see you in a couple of weeks with the next episode. Until then, stay safe.